You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome, fellow island lovers. You're listening to A History of the Caribbean in 100 Objects.
This is a podcast about the rich history of the cultures and societies of the Caribbean told through objects from the earliest period to modern times. I'm Alice Sampson. I'm a Caribbean archaeologist and a lecturer at the University of Leicester.
And I am Angus Moll. I'm also a Caribbean archaeologist and I'm a postdoctoral fellow at Stanford University. In this episode, we are going to talk about a belt buckle from Dominica. And we're not going to do that just with the two of us, because we're still in Alistair's hotel room coming to you through the airwaves. Right, Alice?
Yes, we are. And sitting in my hotel room today, along with Angus, is Zachary Beyer, who's an assistant lecturer at the University of the West Indies Mona Campus in Jamaica. And he's soon to be not just Mr. Zachary Beyer, but Dr. Zachary Beyer, or Dr. Z, as he will be known. So tell us a little bit more about this buckle. In fact, is it a belt buckle?
Well, baldric buckle. These baldric buckles were featured on essentially on the chest of regular British infantry. And the one that we're talking about in question, well, let me kind of take one step back. Baldric buckles, to begin with, are probably one of the most diagnostic buckles on standard issue British military uniforms during the 18th, 19th centuries. They're going to have, you know, particular regimental marks, imperial kind of iconography, really useful for archaeologists to track not only troop movements, but perhaps some of the diversity within the ethnic composition of, you know, the British Army, especially in the colonies. So,
right.
Yes. Featured right in the chest.
And you were talking about iconography. What sort of iconography are we seeing on this particular buckle?
All right. Well, this one in particular, you've got a Roman numeral 6th and then West India Regiment. And in the center of that, you've got a pineapple with some kind of floral arrangements around it. The pineapple in particular is, you see that throughout the Caribbean and Jamaica on other type of, you know, administrative British military garb, really tied to this notion of ornamentalism, especially, you know, in the tropics, right? Yeah.
Yeah, because pineapples are a tropical fruit, right? They come from this part of the world. So, and where was this particular buckle? Where was this particular example found? Did you find it yourself?
Yes, and you know, it's one of those finds happened on one of the closing week of excavations. This is coming from the Cabritz Garrison, Dominica. I was there on a Fulbright in 2010, you know, had the opportunity to do 10 months of research. We excavated in the Cabritz Garrison Labor Village, as well as in the Cabritz Garrison the outer Cabritz soldiers' barracks. But interestingly, this is not coming from the soldiers' barracks. Really, no diagnostic material culture of the West India regiments is coming from there. This came from the enslaved laborer village in a wattle and daub post hole style construction house. So
okay,
interesting.
So this very ornamental thing came from a wattle and daub structure.
Yeah,
instead of from the Cabritz. Could you maybe first tell a little bit more about the Cabritz? What does it look like?
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen it myself in Dominica, and it's a pretty imposing fortress, right?
It's a fortress. Well, and in the administrative record that, you know, all these kind of big forts, they like to call them, you know, the Gibraltar of the Caribbean. And, you know, Brimstone Hill has had that moniker. They've also used it for the Cabritz, but the Cabritz has also been called the Unfortunate Garrison as a result of, you know, malaria, yellow fever, as well as a black garrison. And again, this is, I think, one of the most interesting portions of this artifact, is that it's showing us direct evidence of this recruitment strategy of the British beginning around 1795, of transplanting Africans straight from the west coast of Africa into the Caribbean, arming them, clothing them, paying them along the lines of of regular British infantry.
Right. So you're saying it's direct evidence. How is it direct evidence of this? Because it's a belt buckle. How do we know what's behind this belt buckle? Who was behind this belt
and
buckle?
And all we, the West India Regiment, there would have been no essentially, I mean, European officers, yes, but regular infantry, no. And the European officers would not have necessarily been wearing the same type of ornaments that regular infantry were wearing. And especially the context that it was found in. It was found in association with a bodkin needle. Bodkin needle is typically, you know, kind of a needle with a elongated, larger eye hole used to sew and loop thread through small holes, this type of thing. So it's found with a bodkin needle. Maybe it was used for the actual Baldrick buckle, but actually also found in association with a near complete coarse earthenware cooking vessel, which at least in the context of the Caribbean, oftentimes this local industry, household industry of creating, cooking wares has been associated with enslaved, transplanted, recently freed Africans in the region. Yeah. So really interesting association again. And the soldiers' barracks, where we did a number of a 20% sample shovel test pit, you really didn't see the coarse earthenwares. You saw refined British wares, willow ware, typical of kind of the British military provisioning strategy. But within the labor village, you not only see that stuff, but the refined British wares, you're seeing these local wares, coarse earthenwares, regional wares coming in from Martinique or Guadeloupe, which is also kind of strange because, again, the British were transplanting and arming blacks in to set up for conflict against the French. So you've got, again, not only the presence of this Baldrick buckle in the enslaved labor village, but a really interesting ceramic assemblage that, you know, according to my research, I'm framing this as and thinking about this area as an epicenter for formative interactions that are combining often socially distinct but ethnically similar groups within this military community.
That's really interesting, and it actually reminded me of conversations we had with Todd Ullman. Yeah. When we were talking with him about this enslaved village on St. Kitts, very near Brimstone Hill.
Yes,
this big fort, right, that you mentioned just now. And you know, then we also talked about this parallel informal economy, and Todd was telling us about a coin that was found in a seamstress's house. Who, you know, she probably earned money for basically making clothes. Yep. Alongside the regular work that she had to do. And you know, it sounds like that this was quite a similar context. Mm-hmm. You got the bodkin in this house, and then the buckle was found in association with that.
Yeah, and inside the house, as you said, within the confines, well, in the interior of the house. And what the point that you just made, I think, is, you know, kind of getting at the point here that, again, so often in the Caribbean, especially forts are imagined as these monuments of colonial expansion and the advances of European institutional architecture. But what that kind of skips is, you know, the connection of forts to transatlantic slave markets, as well as to surrounding plantations, that the officers at the Cabritz garrison were heavily involved in the plantation system around. I mean, many of them actually own their own plantations. So mm-hmm. when they were thinking about labor and, you know, how do we essentially push back the tide of, I mean, at the period that we're talking about, there was less than 40,000 regular white infantry in the British Army. So this was a strategy imagined, I think, in relation to, again, the transatlantic slave market and these plantations. How can we, you know, essentially create a sustainable but relatively powerless force that's located here in the Caribbean? And they relied on the same system that plantations were doing.
And tell us a little bit about the plantations on Dominica, because it's a very different island from St. Kitts, right? It's mm-hmm. Dominica is very mountainous.
Yep.
Was it a sugar island? Was it what kind of plantation industries were on Dominica?
Sugar, coffee, and I mean, Mark Hauser's research has really illuminated changes in the plantation industry. He's focused on the south of the island and actually at Sugarloaf, which is in close proximity to the Cabritz garrison. So it was difficult. I mean, some of the primary documents that I read in relation to the fort talk about the plantation system, you know, sputtering and not necessarily catching the wind that some of these initial sugar colonies would have had, like St. Kitts, Barbados, Jamaica. Dominica was never as productive as that, but they most certainly had a variety of plantations. And interestingly enough, we're talking about a region that's just marked by diversity. I'm talking about diversity within the walls of this fortification, which again, for traditional military histories, I think it's a breath of fresh air. But the plantations in Dominica also were owned by French individuals, owned by British, and especially Dominica being between Martinique and Guadeloupe.
It was a pretty strategic place, so they had something to guard there. But at the same time, they also were sort of pestering the other islands, the nearby islands, right?
Yep.
And of course, nowadays, the relations between those islands are great. You got ferries running all the time between them.
Yep.
But it used to be a bit different in the past, right?
Exactly. I mean, these mercantile kind of trade blocks. And this, again, going back to the context in which the Baldric Buckle was found, finding ceramic types like French Valerice from Houvan, Biot. I was surprised to see this within a British military fort that would have been strategically placed to essentially push back French influence. But then we've got a distinctive French material culture, and Miriam Arcangeli's research really brings out those, really highlights the significance of those types of ceramic.
They always get into French somehow, you know, with their culture. It is probably through the good food, right? They probably is.
Well, and look, and we're talking about foodways here. I mean, These are, you know, these are cooking pots. These are storage vessels.
Sure. So. We were in fact talking about foodways just now. Well, just now for us with John Croc in terms of the pre-colonial period, where he was also talking about cooking pots. Mm-hmm. So these things, they pop up. They're all connected.
When does this belt buckle actually date from? We're talking, is it pre-emancipation, presumably? Yeah. But around about the emancipation period as well, what would have happened to these soldiers, these regiments, post-emancipation? Did they set up home in the Caribbean, or can you tell us something about that?
That's a great question. I think I'm going to take... I should walk it back a little bit and provide the history. Again, the West India Regiment are coming out of this strategy in 1795, the British facing diminishing numbers, regular forces, European forces in the region, less than 40,000 at the time. So again, they imagine a new strategy. They first begin trying to work with local assemblies to, similar to what they had been doing in terms of building the fort and maintaining it. They were hiring out plantation laborers, but the reality of plantation owners giving up their property and then this property being armed was a pretty scary reality for most. And this is most certainly the case in Jamaica and Barbados. They really push back against this. Dominica was not as resistant to it. But so you see the British in beginning, 1795, they bypass local island assemblies, and they actually they buy about 14,000 slaves straight from the west coast of Africa.
14,000.
14,000. They had a preference, again, for what they refer to as new Negroes, not Creole or Caribbean-born laborers.
All new immigrants.
All new. So you can imagine the different languages all within these barracks, these military barracks, and these different ethnic identities going on. But then they're all dressed the same. They're all taught the military strategy that was associated with British gentlemen of the time. So They buy 14,000 slaves at a whopping price then of around £750,000. Roger Buckley's work on this essentially lays out the context for this. So they buy these regiments. By 1798, the 6th West India Regiment is located at Dominica. They serve in Dominica 1798 to 1802 when they actually revolt within the walls of the fortification. Kill 7 Europeans, imprison others, and then the British response essentially left 100 of these mutineers dead, supposedly 60 buried in a shallow grave on site, and a handful of them, and this is an interesting historical moment because we have the archives of this, a handful of them were tried in Martinique, and I mean, they were, they might as well have died at the fort because they were sentenced to death. But what we get from that essentially is the rationale of why a revolt would have happened. the British like to frame this according to revolutionary ideas, maybe perhaps spilling from Haiti or France. But many of these individuals said, look, we were afraid that we were going to be transitioned strictly into slave laborers, giving up our guns and trading them in for hoes. Because during that time, 1802, they were being used systematically, essentially to dredge swamps around the Cabritz, modify landscapes. I mean, they weren't doing much armed conflict at that time. So they were most certainly finding themselves more in line with the laborers that would have been situated in the valley of the Cabritz, the area that was excavated. And that wasn't the feeling that they liked. I mean, for them, and how this has been described by many historians, is that this was an opportunity for social mobility. So 6th West India Regiment revolt, they deal with that. The Baldrick Buckle itself, oh, no, I'm sorry, I should be referring to the revolting regiment as the 8th West India Regiment. I apologize. The Baldrick Buckle itself, this is when we get to the 6th West India Regiment. They were stationed, and again, Baldrick Buckles, they're diagnostic. You get the regimental number, but the 6th West India Regiment, when you go through the inspection reports, which are available at the British National Archives, you see that the 6th West India Regiment were located in Dominica between 1808 and 1809, reportedly in very bad discipline. Maybe this is the reason that they were only there for a year or two. But interestingly enough, I mean, this story is full of kind of some fun stuff, that these regiments were actually garrisoned in the south of the island at Scott's Head and at Moore and Bruce. There actually is, at least I haven't found it, specific evidence saying, hey, the 6th West India Regiment was at the Cabritz garrison, but we most certainly have a buckle from the 6th West India Regiment at the garrison. So maybe, you know, the coverage of these military records, we should look at these with a little bit more scrutiny, or perhaps we're actually seeing interaction and exchange and movement across the landscape among these regiments. And to finish your point, you then see the British West India, well, the West India regiments in the Caribbean present throughout about the Napoleonic period, but beginning around 1812, 1815, you start seeing them disbanded to a smaller number of these regiments as a result essentially of dwindling conflict. But then, you know, my other research on the island of Jamaica, you see the rise of different forms, the British West India Regiment coming in World War One, right? So this is a legacy and a heritage that is longstanding, at least throughout the colonial period. But again, it's an interesting point that you see the presence of the West India Regiment, the revolt of the 6th West India Regiment, Dominica, most certainly led up to and probably contributed to the British, you know, the British's end of the slave trade by 1807, but also the Slave Mutiny Act, which was one of the first acts of mass emancipation, where if you were a soldier, that was around 10,000 that they freed at that time, but it wasn't like they're free to do what they wanted to do. They lifetime service, right? So, but technically they were free. Following 1820s, many of these West India Regiment guys would have been pulled from West Coast of Africa, served in the Caribbean. But then with the development of Freetown, Sierra Leone, British endeavors in Africa, they're actually sent back. Regiments are sent back to Africa in order to serve there. And they actually, for a short time, have a recruitment facility for the West India regiments directly in Sierra Leone. And Roger Buckley's work really, really highlights the historiography of that.
We'll try to put a link to one of his books.
Yeah, shout out to Roger Buckley.
All right, shout out to Roger. If you're listening to this, thank you for doing all that heavy work for us, because, you know, archaeologists don't necessarily like to go through all those archives, although, you know, as a historical archaeologist, you probably did your fair share of that.
Well, he made it really easy, I'll tell you what, especially in terms of the administrative record. A lot of my work, though, has been focused on the cartographic evidence to try to track groups and settlement patterns through time, even though many times these are conceived representations, right? It's the ideal imagination. Sure. And, you know, the archaeology that went on the Cabritz Garrison Labor Village most certainly demonstrated that these maps of linear arranged pioneer huts or Negro huts were not as rigidly organized as once, you know, as listed on those maps.
No, yeah, so no that's doubt. That's the nice interplay between history and archaeology, right?
Oh, yeah.
Where we can start going for those little stories through small objects found in unexpected places.
Exactly, exactly.
Very cool. Are there any people that still at Dominica today that have some sort of descendancy to people that have been at the 6th or 8th Regiment?
There's not a whole lot. I mean, in Jamaica, where I'm at now, they have the JDF Military Museum, and most certainly they highlight the history of the West India Regiments. And funny enough, again, this 8th, the 6th West India Regiment, Baldrick Buckle, the 6th, was raised in Jamaica. So I've actually been able to kind of follow the threads, and, you know, employment in Jamaica has allowed me to more fully explore, you know, recruitment practices there. And interestingly enough, the JDF Military Museum has the original flag of the 6th West India Regiment. And it's incredibly rare, and they found it, you know, stumbled upon it in the back of their storeroom or something like that. It's the original colors. Great connection. But speaking to your point, there isn't this firm and fast connection to, oh, my great-great-great-grandfather would have been involved with West India Regiments. There's more of that coming, British West India Regiments, World War I, World War II. And the British National Archives actually has a good initiative going where it's tracking West Indian ancestry, and a lot of this is actually using these regimental records, the military records itself. So again, military heritage in the Caribbean, it's incredibly significant.
So something you said earlier, which was quite interesting, was that these conscripted African regiments in the West Indies saw themselves very different from the enslaved laborers that were there. And of course, they weren't just brought in by the British to fight our, you know, traditional imperial enemies like the French, right? They were also there to capture fugitive slaves,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And again, referring to Roger Buckley's book, he actually wrote it's grounded in history, but he's creating and bringing to life these characters that are identified in the archival record, especially from the court case related to the 1802 8th West India Regiment Slave Soldier Revolt. And how he has imagined this is that, yeah, there's a whole lot of antagonism between West India Regiment soldiers that, yes, were slaves, but very socially distinct, versus enslaved laborers that would have been living within the valley of the fort, but engaged in different types of work. But again, when you think about the revolt of the 8th West India Regiment, a lot of that was coming from, hey, our work is too similar to these enslaved laborers, and we're afraid that once our function as soldiers, then we're going to go straight back to the fields, right? Or straight back to manual labor, which would have been a step at least down or backwards, or a step into a different terrain that they would not have been comfortable with.
So do you know anything about, I mean, did soldiers defect and go and join Maroon communities in the mountains of Dominica? Do we know anything about that?
I don't necessarily know that, but I wouldn't be surprised. But it is interesting that defection among the West India regiments, and again, Buckley's work talks about this, wasn't in fact that high. And when you see again, I keep referring to this kind of important window, this important moment with this revolt at the Cabritz, that when the British are coming in to essentially retake the fort, you have the 8th West India Regiment lining up in standard formation, essentially waving the white flag and saying, hey, you know, we are fighting for the Queen. We are loyal to the British monarch, but we're not going to put down our weapons, and we're not going to be made into field slaves or, you know, right. Laborers. So,
but if you think about the context where this was found, this object, that's kind of weird, right? How does this? Well, maybe we have to sort of leave the realm of history and archaeological fact here, and could we maybe speculate a little bit about how this buckle came to be there by itself? There's no uniform attached to it, so how does this happen? What do you think?
Well, and I mean, we're talking again about a context that, within the same structure, you're finding not many gun parts, not many other regimental buttons. Like I mentioned, the coarse earthenware, local coarse earthenwares, regional French wares, a lot of tools, an axe, a knife, something like a chisel. So I've imagined that this structure, and the post holes are large, and perhaps with a ceramic tile roof that would have been, you know, kind of matching up with the institutional aesthetic that you would have seen throughout the Fort Garrison, right? Like these brightly orange roofs. And so you would have had kind of like a barrack style structure within this enslaved laborer village. But I've often, you know, I've sat back and said, what's going on here? Are soldiers from this outer Cabritz soldiers barracks coming down, interacting with enslaved laborers? Again, we find, okay, lots of bottle glass fragments, modified ceramics. There was one example of that into a game piece, right? Or a lot of tobacco pipes. So are we having maybe social interaction among, again, these ethnically similar but socially distinct segments of the British Army? Or maybe these West India Regiment soldiers, according to their administrative kind of logic, are very similar to these enslaved laborers that were, again, very common throughout the 18th, 19th century on this force. So let's just place them in the same location. Let's house them in the same area. So perhaps that's what we're seeing. But it's open for imagination.
I could see that. You know, I've lost plenty of buttons when I was having social interactions
drinking
that involved a bit of drinking.
And having a little bit of fun.
You know, that happens. That happens.
And why would you want to spend all your time up at Cabritz? You know, if you want to have some time off, go down into the village, get someone to mend the hole in your uniform. I mean, it kind of makes sense, right? That we shouldn't see these worlds as completely distinct and separate.
And I think that most certainly is the point. And there's a lot of literature that is essentially, you know, talking about how socially distinct these individuals would have been. But we know that within this centralized location, within the fort walls, that you would have had most certainly a certain level of fluidity and fuzziness. And, you know, and this isn't, I don't even want to just conceive of this as a masculine environment. Chances are, I mean, in the historical record, there's women in this place. They're wash women. They're working in the hospital. Maybe the great ceramic diversity that we're seeing within the labor village is also a result of, you know, and I'm kind of going on a limb here, also the result of either, you know, the temporary presence of women or maybe perhaps women living within the settlement. So,
sure.
Interesting sight, most certainly.
For sure, most certainly. If we've been talking about this for a long time already, and probably we could talk about it for a long, long time more. So, but I guess we have to wrap it up. But I feel we probably next SAAs, or maybe we see you at Ayaka sometimes, we can talk about a bit more about the research that you're doing on Jamaica. And I guess for now, that's going to be it, right, Alice?
I think it is. I think we should say thanks so much, Zachary, for coming to join us today. And thank you also to all our listeners listening to this episode of A History of the Caribbean and 100 Objects, where we discuss this fascinating baldric buckle from Dominica. And please go to Shores of Time for illustrations of the belt buckle. We'll be putting up a photograph which Zachary has given us, so you can check out the pineapple on the front of it. Mm-hmm.
For sure. And if you could give us ratings on iTunes, that'd be lovely. I mean, give us some good ratings, because we've had a couple of very cool guests on recently, and these people, they deserve 5 stars. So give us some good ratings on iTunes. But most importantly, share this with your friends and family. And you're also sharing this with people, right? This podcast.
Oh, most certainly. Look, I do want to highlight the significance of a forum like this. Teaching in Jamaica, teaching classes like, you know, Caribbean archaeology to undergraduates. I mean, they're all on their phones anyway, social networking, all these things. This is a great use and a great introduction to just the variety and the complexity that's going on within the Caribbean region. So thank you for the opportunity.
No, thank you so much for joining us. And if any of your students or anybody else wants to reach us, they can do that through Twitter at Shores of Time, or they can go to our website, shoresoftime.com, and they can comment there. Or, you know, probably we should also start thinking about a Facebook page, Alice. I know you're not very Facebooky, but we probably should be doing it. maybe you'll see us on Facebook as well, but regardless whether you see us on Facebook or not, we will see you next episode. And until then, remember what the great Bob Marley said: in this great future, you can't forget your past.
See Peter Siegel.
That's Peter Siegel. We're just going to be very, very rude, because Peter Siegel seems to be talking to an important person.
He's talking to.
Well, we're gonna be kind of rude.
We're gonna be kind of rude and butt into your conversation.
Yes. Sorry, Peter. Sorry for butting into your conversation. Okay. But have you heard that Alice and I, we are recording a podcast? It's called A History of the Caribbean in 100 Objects.
100 Objects.
Yeah, well, this is kind of a benchmark thing. So we hope to get to 100, or we hope that we can sort of stick it to 100 because there's so many cool objects, right?
Cool objects. Okay.
Objects from earlier times, modern times.
Yeah.
Whatever sort of cool object from the Caribbean one. And we've been going around this lobby asking all the Caribbean archaeologists in this room a very simple yet difficult question. Yeah. What is your one favorite object from the Caribbean?
My one favorite object from the Caribbean. Man, you're putting me on the spot.
We are.
Yeah, that's kind of the point.
That's kind of the point. Okay, let me think about this for about less than 15 seconds.
That's okay. What?
Okay, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I'm going to give you 15 seconds to think about it because we've been talking to a lot of people this evening. We tried to get Rosa, but she ran away because we thought she might answer that her favorite Caribbean object was you.
Okay. Okay. Only one?
Only one. We have to be strict here, Peter. Sorry.
Okay. I'm getting nervous now. My one favorite object from the Caribbean is...
He's stalling for time.
Hundreds of objects are flashing through his brain.
Yes. The sediment sample from about 450 centimeters below ground surface on Marie Galante, associated with a very dramatic change in the environment caused by humans.
There you go. Only in archaeology, people. Peter's very favorite object. There's so many lovely objects to choose from, and he chooses a bit of dirt.
You know, but I think that says something very important about archaeologists, because I think a lot of people who don't know what archaeologists do possibly think, possibly especially in the Caribbean, that we're treasure hunters, and Peter's just completely disproved that.
Yeah, for sure.
Can I have a second object?
Yeah, go on.
Okay, my second object is a really cool side of a constricted ceramic solidoid Hacienda Grande style pot with a face on it, which is also on the cover of Ancient Borinquen.
Yeah.
And that, I'm convinced, is an image of a shaman.
All right. Very cool.
I would bet $100 that it's a shaman.
And for an archaeologist, $100 is quite a pretty sum.
Yeah, that could fund a whole season's excavation.
Or about 10 beers at this hotel.
All right. That sounds like two other objects, you know, including the sediment core, that we should talk about at some point in a future episode.
Yeah, Peter, if we could talk to you at some point in the future at greater length about any of those, that'd be great.
Okay, I'll be happy to do it.
All right, thanks, cool. Peter. You're cheers. You know what? We're just going to go for it. Rosa, there she is.
Are we going to hijack Rosa?
We're going to hijack Rosa, because...
This is so Angus, isn't it?
the beer in the pocket. Yeah, the beer in the pocket. It's very sad. Which is not Angus. Usually the beer's not empty.
Not empty. Not empty. And not in my pocket. Normally it's in my hand, going towards my face. We're talking to Rosa. Your last name is Seagull officially, or is it something else?
Garcia. I never changed it.
You never changed it. So you're married to Peter Seagull. We just talked to, but you're called Rosa Garcia. And you know. Now you don't really do much archaeology anymore, but you did do quite a bit of archaeology at the same site that Peter worked at, right?
Right. We worked together for 7 years at Ma Isabel in Puerto Rico.
So you have seen quite a couple of very cool and pretty objects there.
Oh, amazing things.
There you go. So you can choose one of those, or you can choose any other object from the Caribbean, but we have a very simple yet difficult question for you.
Okay.
What is your favorite object in the Caribbean?
Asking what is your favorite song?
Yeah, for sure.
pretty much. Actually, maybe we have two questions for you. First, what is your favorite object? And second, what do you think Peter said when we asked the same question?
A long time ago, for Peter, it would have been something in lithics, but now I'm not sure. From the Caribbean, perhaps red on white ceramic.
Pretty close. He did mention some saladoid pottery. That's true.
The saladoid face that's also on the cover of his book.
Oh yes.
Yeah, the of course. Face. Of yeah. course. That's yeah. a pretty. Yeah. That's a pretty face.
That is.
But you know, he's also married a pretty face, who also has her own opinions.
Full of compliments.
Full of compliments.
That's the beer.
You're just being jealous of us.
I was very impressed by the burials at Ma Isabel.
All right.
I mean, I was impressed by the quantity of ceramics because compared to the Midwest where we used to work, no comparison. You know, you could pick up a shirt and you weren't sure if it was a shirt or a piece of mud. Once in Pennsylvania, he thought he had a unique shirt. It turned out to be the bottom of a rifle barrel with this little waffle.
He didn't tell us about that.
He's probably going to ask us to cut that bit, but we won't.
No.
They figured it out at the State Museum when someone pulled out a match. he was frantic, but then they realized, oh, okay, it's rubber. It's not ceramic.
Oh, dear.
Actually, you know, that's really interesting what you say about the burials being so rich in terms of grave goods, because one of the things that we often find in the Caribbean or think about the Caribbean is that people were not buried with a lot of grave goods.
So but they are. At Mazabel, they most certainly were.
At Mazabel, they were, yeah.
So any of those grave goods that were buried with those people there that particularly caught your eye?
The unique thing was the vessel that was filled with soil and it had teeth in it.
Oh,
and okay. I'm not sure what age those teeth
human,
were.
Human teeth.
Yeah, human teeth, yeah. They were pretty young. So I don't remember if there were bones in there as well that had decomposed, but I do remember there were teeth found in that vessel.
Wow.
That's, and then the other burial was the one that had what looked like a projectile point. I think it was out of a manta ray. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. I don't really have the whole database of Isabella in my head.
But it was in the ribs.
Oh, the stingray spine in the ribs. Yeah, that's a very famous burial in the Caribbean.
Yeah. We probably have to talk about it at some point as well, Alice.
Yeah, we should.
Maybe we should get another beer.
Yep. Thanks very much, Rosa.
Thanks very much. All right, thank you.
We are.
And the fun just never stops, people. Oh,
we've just been handed a flyer. It's probably to some crazy party because Betsy Carlson has just handed this to us.
Yes, Betsy Carlson.
Betsy Carlson is a crazy party animal and one of our favorite Caribbean archaeologists.
Yes, she is.
We're having a speakeasy upstairs. It's called the Blind Armadillo, which comes from an old word, the blind pig, which what they used to call places during Prohibition. When you couldn't get in, they called them blind pigs because they couldn't call them a place to go drink. So we're having a little party called the Blind Armadillo because the armadillo is the Florida UF
animal.
It's our animal. And I hear they're tasty. I heard that this morning in a session.
You have a thing going on called the Armadillo Roast, right?
Yes, we do that every year.
Yeah,
the archaeology department roasts an armadillo.
And eat it.
Roadkill, usually.
Yeah. It's reused.
And
we do
eat it.
Yeah, eating roadkill is a good thing as long as it hasn't been lying on the road too long.
But what we kind of want to talk to you about is an armadillo is not a Caribbean. I mean, Florida is kind of the Caribbean, but not the Caribbean island creature. What we do want to know, because we've been talking to all the Caribbean archaeologists so far that we've put corner, is what is your favorite object in the Caribbean? You can pick just one.
Object.
It can be anything. It can be anything from as old as you can think of to a modern object like a car or a painting or
artifact or eco-fact, Betsy, doesn't matter.
Who is going to hear this?
We do not know. This is going to be out on the internet.
Whoever you send the link to.
So maybe don't divulge any information that you know should not be divulging. She has a look of mischief on her
hair. Yeah, this is not live. We think Betsy's going
to
reveal.
I have a favorite artifact, but I am sworn to secrecy about it, and I can't tell you what it is.
Oh, my goodness. This means we need to go to the Blind Armadillo and find this out. But
blind.
Let's ask Betsy after the Blind Armadillo party. Then I think she'll reveal all.
One beer. Call me later. I'll tell you what my favorite artifact is.
Okay, so your favorite artifact. Your second favorite artifact, then.
Second favorite artifact.
Or the third, whatever artifact you can start talking about.
Whatever non-secret artifact.
Favorite non-secret artifact.
Yeah.
That's a hard question.
It is.
Okay, last year in St. Thomas, there's a lot of great artifacts out of this excavation we did on Main Street, but we found a shell frog.
Ooh.
A little frog carved out of conch shell with the four legs, and he had It looks just like a frog. Absolutely beautiful.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, so not one of those like flat pendants, but like a 3D.
It's more like a flat pendant. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
One of those. One of those are nice. And we also got a complete carnelian bead out of that site. The site was just nice.
What's the name of the site?
It's the Main Street site.
Of course. You know, archaeologists and their imagination.
It's because it was in the main street of Charlotte Amalie underneath the road. It's the main road. So,
cool. Any date on it?
What was that?
Any date on it?
Date on the site? It's about 300 BC.
Ooh,
so it's an old one.
Yeah,
it's
early.
Definitely Saladoid. It has white on red pottery. It has Zik pottery. Beautiful stuff. Really, really nice.
Wow.
So from there. And does it have to be Caribbean? Because I do have a favorite artifact from my life as an archaeologist.
All right. Well, you know what? Throw it in there. We throw it in as a bonus bit.
Throw it in there. I went to field school when I was just like 25 out in the Southwest and was digging at a mission site and excavated a complete black and white painted Anasazi pot.
Wow.
Never dug before in my life.
You're kind of a lucky person there.
That is a find of a lifetime.
As a sign that
you were predestined
to do
Caribbean archaeology. That's weird.
And then you never find anything like that again.
No, it's
the rule.
Yeah, but in fact, you're not only a Caribbean archaeologist. You excavate in a lot of places. You work in a lot of places, right?
So mostly in the Southeast.
Yeah, no, you do get
but
around.
I will do anything.
There you go. And that's a true archaeologist. Go anywhere for a cool object.
I figure I have a brain. I can read. I can learn anything. I can do it.
There you go.
Yeah.
A brain, a book, and a beer maybe at some point.
A material object, beer-focused brain. That's what an archaeologist needs.
That's all we need. Thank you so much for
a talk. Come by and have a beer. I filled the whole bathtub up. The whole thing is filled with beer, among other things.
A whole bathtub of full of my favorite objects.
I would say see you at 7.
Yeah.
Which is in about 5 minutes. So I think that wraps that up, ladies and gentlemen.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Betsy.
This podcast is part of the Creative Commons under the Attribution ShareAlike 4.0 International License, and it was made possible thanks to a Rubicon grant from the Netherlands Organization for Scientific Research.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.